It's at 9:06.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Just in time for Earth Day this year, the New Hampshire Department of Environmental Services came out with a new tool to answer a basic question: how's our environment doing? Our guest today, DES Commissioner Thomas Burak, calls it the Environmental Dashboard. It's an online status update of how well the state's performing on key issues, from recycling solid waste to protecting groundwater to the health of the Great Bay. The dashboard is just one of the many projects before the commissioner these days. Others include his work on the Site Evaluation Committee, which approves alternative energy projects, also gearing up to battle invasive species in New Hampshire waterways this summer, and the recent winning of a huge jury award related to ExxonMobil's use of the carcinogenic gasoline additive MTBE. Today in The Exchange, Commissioner Burak is back to talk about this and other issues before his agency. And let's hear from you, too. How would you assess the environmental health of our state and of your particular area of it? What more do you think Burak's department could do to improve the environment? And if your town or business is regulated by DES, how effective or appropriate do you think those regulations are? Give us a call. Tell us what you think. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email if you'd like, exchange@nhpr.org, or post a comment on our Facebook page. And Commissioner Burak, welcome back. Good to see you.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here with you.
Well, and you've been commissioner for 7 years, and we've had lots of conversations over those years, the better part of a decade, really. What major changes have you seen, Commissioner, over those years, either in our environment itself or the way that we approach environmental policy?
Well, I think in terms of our environment itself, we have seen steady but not dramatic improvement overall in air quality, in water quality. We've made huge progress in cleaning up a lot of our contaminated sites, and we're getting a much better understanding of some of the challenges that we face, for example, in terms of water quality, whether it's in Great Bay or in water bodies across the state, and a sense of what we're going to need to be doing going forward to address stormwater and management of runoff off of our lands into our precious waters. So those are some of the areas where we've made progress and where we have more progress to make. In terms of how we approach all of this, one of the, from my perspective, really exciting things that's been happening in state government over the past really 8 years or so is a movement away from each department thinking of itself as being its own little kingdom or fiefdom to really viewing themselves as being part of an organic whole, part of an integrated and unified system of state government, a single enterprise in which we all work together, recognizing that we're much better together sharing our limited resources and taking advantage of the expertise and the perspectives that we all can bring to the table. And particularly over the past 4 or 5 years, we've had a group of some 24 or so of the commissioners from the larger and middle-sized agencies getting together voluntarily on a monthly basis to look at how can we work together to really improve the operations of state government.
So give us an example of what you're talking about.
Well, one example would be the very first project we undertook was to develop a set of customer service principles that we encourage all departments in state government to look to as a set of guideposts for how we go about serving each other, and equally importantly, serving the public, recognizing that everyone is our customer. We are each other's customers. And if we can work together, we can support each other, we can treat each other with dignity and respect, we can make a huge impact in terms of improving service to the people of New Hampshire.
Do you get involved in other commissioners' purviews? Here's an example that comes to mind for me, Commissioner Burak. You're obviously interested in clean air, combating climate change, and so forth. Department of Transportation is expanding I-93 with the potential to bring dirtier air and increase climate change, more cars and more people and so forth. No rail option there. That's been debated over the years. Do you get to that level and say, look, Transportation Commissioner, how come no rail?
I wouldn't say we would approach it in quite that way, but what I can tell you is that we have, going back at least 5 years or so, had regular meetings between senior leadership of the Department of Transportation, Department of Environmental Services, to look at the whole range of issues that we're working on together. whether it might be the expansion of I-93, chloride issues either there on I-93 or elsewhere in the state, working together on air quality issues and how we can work together to promote more use of transit and bus service, for example. All those kinds of communications are occurring all the time at a leadership level and at a staff level. And truly, relationships have been built, certainly between our two departments, that is, Environmental Services and Transportation, but among and between multiple agencies and state government in ways that I don't think existed in the past. I think we have been able to build a set of communications that have allowed us to build relationships, that have allowed us to build trust. And when you do those things, you get better, more effective government. And I think that's what we've accomplished.
Our phone number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. Today in the Exchange, we're sitting down with Tom Burak, Commissioner of New Hampshire's Department of Environmental Services. He's been in that position for 7 years. Before that, he was in private law practice doing environmental and energy work. And we're talking about just some of the changes he's seen over that time, either in the environment itself or as he's been explaining the way that government approaches environmental policy. 1-800-892-6477 is the number for you to join us. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. I also want to ask you another sort of philosophical question, Commissioner Burak. Two values of New Hampshire public life that may affect the work you do. One is a small government philosophy, and the other is a strong commitment to local control. How do these two items, if I could call them that, affect the way that your agency does its work?
In short, very directly, we recognize that some of our many vitally important partners are the communities across the state, more than 200 of them across the state, and they all have their own unique characters and approaches sometimes to things, but they all have many things in common, which is that they want to do the right thing, they want to be able to provide a high quality of life for their residents, but they want to do it in the most cost effective manner they can, and they want to know that they're spending their dollars, they're devoting their resources in ways that will really make a difference for them short term and long term. And so as a department, we are very committed across all of our programs to providing, to the extent within our budget limits we can, providing technical assistance to communities, helping them think through the issues, helping them get through, if it's permitting processes they need to get through, helping them to work through those processes, or if it's a matter of studying water quality in a lake or a river, working with them to help them understand that, help them understand what the causes of the problems may be, whether they're illicit discharges or whatever else, and really try to be a true partner in solving the problems. And our belief is that that approach makes a big difference. And we try very hard to communicate with the communities on a regular basis. So, for example, we have a monthly electronic newsletter, the Municipal EcoLink, that we put out to municipal boards, commissions, whether planning boards, conservation commissions, that just is a one-page list of some of the key grant opportunities that may be coming up for municipalities, training sessions that may be coming, changes in regulatory programs that may be of interest to them, just as a way of trying to get better communications with the municipalities.
How does that tradition of local control affect the way that you work with communities? And I guess what I'm trying to say, Commissioner Burak, is, you know, do you ever have a situation where you tell a town, look, you really need to do this, and the town says, well, no, we don't want to, and no, we don't have to? I mean, the idea of local control means the locals decide, maybe not the state. I'm just wondering where those boundaries are.
Well, I think those boundaries really are defined in statute and regulation, ultimately. Whether they're federal laws that we're charged with implementing or they are state laws. But we will do our very best to work cooperatively with communities, help them find paths forward that make sense. And I think it's very rare that, in fact, a community would say, we just refuse to do something that the law or regulations would require us to do. Oftentimes, it's just a matter of helping, whether they're communities, individuals, businesses, helping them to understand, first of all, why the laws exist, what the harm is they're intended to prevent, and then helping them to understand what the best ways are to go about complying in a manner that is going to be effective and cost-effective and that's going to be sustainable over the long term.
What are some of the issues where communities struggle, where they may say, yeah, we'd love to do this, but boy, it's hard. We can't afford it. It's too big an investment.
Well, here's a great example. In the area of culverts, and every community has many, many culverts under their roads. And under our old wetlands rules, it used to be that if you wanted to replace a culvert as a municipality, with very limited exceptions, you had to come in for a permit to be able to get approval to be able to replace that culvert. After a number of years of studying the situation, listening to the communities, hearing their concerns, we determined that we were going to work with them and develop an alternative approach under which we now can, working with the technology center there at the University of New Hampshire, we can have municipal public works staff get some training, pass a basic course, and get certified to be able to do these culvert designs and installations in a manner that we know is going to comply with the basic requirements.
So then
they don't have to come in with a separate permit. They get a certification. They can do this work themselves. They just report to us which culverts they've replaced and when. And it allows them actually to also go out and help other towns in a mutual aid kind of a way. So effectively, we're moving from more of a command and control approach to more of a either what we call a first party or a third party certification approach, where we know that we have trained people out there who know what the right things are to do, and they're just going to go out and do them. And because they've had the training, we're going to trust that it's going to be done and it's going to be done right.
Well, and with the huge floods that we saw in the mid-2000s, we all learned the importance of culverts. It seems boring and detailed, but it makes a big difference when you're having a 100-year flood. We're going to talk more after a short break, Commissioner Burak, and we will start taking your calls and emails for the commissioner. Your questions, comments about New Hampshire's environment and environmental policy are welcome at 1-800-892-6477.
This is NHPR 919. Good morning. Support this news service by becoming a member of NHPR's Leadership Circle at the $1,000 level. When you do, current Circle members Tillman Gerngross, Sylvia Richards, and Barbara and Dick Couch will add $500 onto your gift. Your money goes further today when you join the NHPR Leadership Circle. Visit the support page at nhpr.org. More with New Hampshire Department of Environmental Services Commissioner Thomas Burak on The Exchange. And at 10 on The Diane Rehm Show, the growing debate over capital punishment. Support for NHPR comes from UR members and from the NEEP Network organizations working with the New Hampshire Department of Education to increase the college aspirations of local students at iamcollegebound.org. And from Home Health Care, Hospice, and Community Services, offering geriatric care management for seniors from offices in Keene, Peterborough, and Charlestown. HCSservices.org. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're sitting down with New Hampshire Department of Environmental Services Commissioner Tom Burak, and let's hear from you. 1-800-892-6477. Overall, how would you assess the environmental health of our state, our water, our land, and our air? How is your particular area of the state doing in terms of the environment? What more do you think Tom Burak's department could do to improve our natural environment? And if you're regulated by DES, either as a municipality or as a business, how appropriate, how effective do you think those regulations are? Let's hear from you. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page. And before we go to our listeners, Commissioner Burak, one more sort of philosophical question, if I could. You've talked a lot about how a quarter century ago, when DES was set up, the environmental problems that we faced as a state and a nation were really more in your face, you know, toxic waste dumps, rivers filled with sludge, and so forth. Now you've said the problems are less obvious. What are you talking about there?
What we're talking about here are that we are certainly facing a changing climate over time. And day to day, we don't notice those differences. But as this climate does change, we are seeing changes. We are seeing shorter winters, longer summers. We're seeing more extreme storm events. When the precipitation does come, there just tends to be more of it in a shorter period of time. And those are the kinds of things that we're talking about in terms of climate change. And again, we may not necessarily see those as a change in our environment, but they really are. And we have to do things to both mitigate, that is to try to prevent more of that from occurring, but also as best we can to adapt to those changing conditions. At the same time, we're also, because of the growth that we have experienced in the state and the
population growth,
the pressures on our state's natural resources, particularly our water supplies, we're seeing differences in what's available to us to support us and the stresses and strains on those resources. We're also seeing just more traffic out there in places, people having to wait at traffic lights more. That is also a set of signs and symptoms of a changing environment and a changing set of really factors that affect our quality of life. And when we go out and we ask folks, what have you seen in terms of changes in New Hampshire over the past 25 years or so, one of the big things people who have been here for a while will talk about is, I don't remember this amount of traffic. I don't remember this amount of development, this number of homes, this number of buildings. I remember more open fields, open spaces. And the challenge that we have is, as we continue to grow as a state, and I think we will and we should continue to grow as a state, we want to make sure that we are using our state's natural resources in a way that's going to sustain us for the long term. That is, we're not going to use it all up now and leave nothing for future generations. We want to make sure that future generations have as good, if not a better, environment here in New Hampshire that as we enjoy today.
And in some instances, they are already. I mean, again, people who've been here a long time talk about the Merrimack River and how much better it is today and so forth. And yet there are these other challenges that are having a more negative impact. That seems
to be
what you're saying.
That's right.
Let's take some comments from our listeners, Commissioner Bjorklund, and then we have a lot more to talk about. Again, the number for you to join our conversation with Department of Environmental Services Commissioner Tom Burek is 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. And first up is Beth in Sharon. Hi, Beth. Thanks for waiting. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you, Laura. I love your show, and when I donated to NHPR this year, I stipulated that the money go towards the exchange. So thank you for having me.
Awesome, Beth. Thanks a lot.
My question, I live in Sharon, which nobody knows where that is, but it's down by Peterborough and Temple and Jaffrey, and there's one of the proposed wind energy farms is right there in sort of three, you know, overlapping three towns, and so there's a lot of talk in our area about that, and I've been talking to some of our town officials, and, you know, I think that there are so many of us who are really eager to, you know, do whatever we can with green energy and improving the environment, but I think sometimes we're so eager to do that that we don't fully investigate what is being proposed. And so, you know, wind energy sounds great, but one of the things that I'm hearing, well, two things actually. One is that some people can become very sick from living near these farms from some sort of, you know, frequency of sound that maybe most of us don't hear, sort of the way that dogs hear frequencies that humans don't. So that's one thing that I'm concerned about. But I'm also really concerned because what I have heard is that the energy produced by a wind farm in our area would not be used in the state of New Hampshire, but would be going to Rhode Island. And I've talked
so do we really need this, Beth?
Right, exactly. And I've talked to people who are really in favor of this farm until they hear that, and then they say, well, wait a minute.
Why bother?
You know, why would I want to do that when we don't even benefit from the energy?
Well, and Beth, huge, huge issues, and I'm glad you called. And your work, Commissioner Burek, you're on what's called the Site Evaluation Committee. Are you chair of that committee, in fact? Is that correct?
That's correct.
So what is this committee, first of all, and then we can get into some of the issues that Beth is talking about.
Sure. The Site Evaluation Committee is a committee established by state law, which is designed to provide an integrated and unified permitting review process for large-scale energy projects, whether they might be a facility that's generating power. Could be a wind facility, could be a natural gas plant, could be a coal-burning power plant, for example. But it could also include any kind of a energy transmission line, whether it were for electricity or a gas pipeline, for example. And so this board was established more than 20 years ago to provide, as I say, a unified integrated permitting approach. And by statute, the commissioner of the Department of Environmental Services serves as chairman of that board or committee, but there are some 15 or so different positions at high levels across numerous departments in state government that are also assigned to serve on this board, which convenes on an ad hoc basis as necessary to hear these applications when they are filed. And in recent years, we have seen a significant increase in the number of applications and in the overall amount of activity because, as we all know, there have been rapid changes in the energy markets and energy fields. Under state statute, for example, our renewable portfolio standard is really intended to encourage the development of more renewable energy sources in the state. So I think it's a well-designed statute, particularly for what circumstances were some years ago. It creates certain challenges for me and other members of the committee in that we have to be very careful that we not take positions on matters publicly that would suggest that we have prejudged any matters that are before the committee or likely to come before the committee. And we certainly can't engage in what would be called ex parte communications, that is, speak with parties who are involved on one side of a matter that's before us or could come before us and not have the other folks who are of perhaps a contrary view in the room or involved in the conversation at the same time. So that means I simply can't speak to the specifics of these matters.
Sure, I appreciate that. But the committee itself has been criticized. The process, you know, doesn't take into account local concerns such as the one Beth raises. She didn't mention home values, but that's come up. She's worried about health impacts. She's raised a concern that a lot of people raise, Commissioner Burak, you know, whether these projects really help New Hampshire or whether it's more of a just a New England thing. So I know you can't comment on the specifics of her project in her backyard, but what about this unhappiness that we hear more and more of lately with the system? People feel like it's not good enough anymore. Doesn't respond to their concerns.
We have heard that very, very clearly. We obviously are guided by the statute as it is currently written. We have been involved in conversations with the legislature over this past year, looking at various pieces of legislation and, in fact, encouraging the legislature to take a fresh look at this situation in light of all the rapid changes that are occurring, the additional strains that this rapid change is placing on all of the state agencies who are involved in this process, and asking the question, is there possibly a new, better, or different way to go about doing this work? While at the same time, certainly we will continue to do what we are obligated by statute to do, which I think we can continue to do effectively, while analysis is being done of whether perhaps by looking at what other states are doing and learning whether there are other states.
Yeah, what do they do? Well, what do other places do better than we do?
It appears that different states approach these in different manners. And we're only just beginning to study how other states approach this challenge and what are some good lessons to be learned there. What are some good practices that might be incorporated into New Hampshire's approach? And I think that this is a healthy and important conversation for us to have as a state, and I know that there are already legislative committees looking at this, and there's likely to be legislation this year, or there's certainly legislation under consideration now that would have this issue further studied over the next year or so.
You know, Commissioner Burak, as concerns come up more and more, boy, it seems like every other week there's a concern about a wind farm, and then, of course, there's hydropower projects, especially Northern Pass. So these keep coming up, and the site evaluation committee is involved in that, of course. Then on the other side, some people are saying, hey, you know, this is green NIMBYism. I mean, if you're going to embrace a clean energy future, you might have to give something up. What do you think? Are we engaging a little green NIMBYism here? Not in my backyard.
Well, I want to be careful about not throwing labels around here. I think it's important to understand a couple of things. One is, when we talk about energy and energy markets, at least as we currently approach this across New England, we are in fact in a regional market. So while one can say that energy generated, for example, in Maine is not going to be used in Maine, it's only going to be used in Massachusetts, the reality is that electricity is in fact constantly moving all around across New England. And so I think it's somewhat, although the contracts may be written with particular entities in a particular state that may be different from where the energy is originally generated, the reality is that you can't distinguish one electron from another on the grid. The contracts are presumably being written in order to ensure that there's sufficient power overall to meet the needs across the region. The other thing I think it's really important to understand is what it is that the legislature was trying to do when it established the Site Evaluation Committee back, some 20 years or so now, more than 20 years ago now, which I think was to provide a predictable and uniform process for how these matters are handled, and to do so in a way that ensured that the concerns at the local level were heard, were considered, but that also ensured that as we're looking at the need for new energy facilities, that we're really looking at this from a big picture perspective.
Yeah, it's tricky, though, because people have their own local concerns like Beth, and then you have the whole, you know, New England power need.
Absolutely.
It's a tough balance.
Absolutely. And I think the balance that the legislature struck was saying that we're going to effectively preempt local planning and zoning ordinances in the case of these large-scale projects because they arguably are of statewide, if not regional, significance, and therefore it's appropriate that there be a decision made from that state perspective.
Yeah, and that's upsetting to people, and also gets back to that local control value that we have here in New Hampshire. So, boy, we could talk for a lot longer on this, Commissioner Burek, for sure. Beth, thank you so much for raising that. And let's go back to our listeners, 1-800-892-6477. And Phil is next. He's in Chester. Hi, Phil. You're on the Exchange with Commissioner Burek. Go ahead.
Hi, how are you doing? Thanks for the opportunity.
Sure.
I'm on a conservation commission here, and we went through the prime wetlands identification process, which is useful in itself, but when it came time to offer that to the citizens, there was a major upswell against it, and which I wasn't too surprised at. But I have the question. I mean, it's a good system, or we wouldn't have in concept.
What were the citizens up against, Phil? I'm not.
Well, yeah, a prime wetlands designation, which
I see.
Describe better than I can, but. And so the concern was that they felt that they could take care of the land better than the state would be due to the, I guess, understaffing and the long wait that they allege, so that if there's storm damage or beaver issues or invasives or whatever, that if they, under prime wetlands, it's a good concept that, you know, the state comes and helps to determine what's the next best course of action. But they're saying that delay would lead actually to further damage.
Oh, so the locals, they'd rather take care of it themselves. They feel like the state is too slow.
Yes, and I'm just wondering if maybe that third-party certification or if there's any other, I didn't know what to come back at them with, so we just respectfully withdrew and thought, well, maybe they're right, you know, and that's a real shame. So
well,
let's
Phil,
hoping, find out about that.
Yeah, and thanks for, you know, volunteering on your local conservation commission. That is another part of this whole, you know, local control, local values. Local people like Phil are, you know, they're volunteering their time and energy to help make New Hampshire a better place. So that's great. Go ahead, Commissioner Burek.
Thank you. And thank you, Phil, for this comment and sharing the story with us and for your service on your local conservation commission. Clearly, local CONCOMs play a key role in helping folks at the local level to appreciate the beauty of their own towns and to protect vital resources in their communities. I think the Prime Wetlands Program is one that has certainly had its challenges. I think it's one that certainly many communities have been able to successfully implement. I suspect that there is a fair amount of misunderstanding out there about what truly it means to designate a wetland as a prime wetland, which really, as I understand it and see it, is simply a way for a community to say, this to us is an important resource that we really want to make sure is protected and preserved. I am concerned that the impression out there is that if something has to go to DES, that it's going to take a long time to get resolved, because one of our real missions at DES is to provide the best customer service that we can and to be as responsive as quickly as we can to the needs and concerns and questions that may arise. And certainly, if you want to contact us, I'm sure that our staff would be happy to sit down with you and folks from your CONCOM to answer your questions about prime wetlands designation and better understand the concerns that you heard being raised by folks in your community about that.
Okay. Well, thanks a lot for that call. And again, wetlands, I mean, people who work in conservation commissions, also your water monitors, Commissioner Burek, that's another example of citizens kind of doing some of the work that maybe in other states government agencies would do.
Absolutely. We are very fortunate here in New Hampshire to have hundreds of volunteers each summer who go out on our lakes and our rivers and collect water samples to take to laboratories, whether they're here at our offices in Concord or at Plymouth State, or UNH has a similar program, and really allow us to get a very good understanding every year of what's going on in our lakes and rivers.
And this summer, as we talk about the approach of the warm weather and people going to the beaches, and we talk about invasive species and little bits of milfoil and so forth ending up on boats, the volunteers are a huge part of that, aren't they? Keeping that stuff out of the lakes.
They absolutely are. And I think it's just an indication, Laura, of how much people really do love New Hampshire, that they're willing to take the time, their own time, to do these things, not just for their own benefit, for the benefit of all of us.
All right. I've got lots more calls and emails that I want to throw at you, Commissioner Burek, after a short break. And you can join us, too, at 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page if you'd like, or send us a short email, the address exchange@nhpr.org, exchange@nhpr.org, or call 1-800-892-6477. And a lot more from you coming up in just a minute.
This is NHPR. Support comes from UR members and Gripponi Auto Group, featuring multiple lines of fuel-efficient, environmentally friendly cars at Gripponi Auto Junction in Bow and online 24 hours a day at gripponi.com. And Cedar Crest Center for Children with Disabilities hosting the 10th annual Kentucky Derby Benefit May 4th. Information, auction catalog, and tickets at cedarcrestcenter.org. It's 9:40. This is NHPR.
What people say in the public square is important for citizens to know about.
Which is why you turned to NHPR and Josh Rogers, senior political reporter.
I do my best to pay attention to what public officials say and do, to hold public officials to some account.
New Hampshire's Newsroom, covering New Hampshire's political news. NHPR and NHPR.org.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on The Exchange, it's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. Email us your thoughts on the top stories of the week at exchange@nhpr.org. And join us tomorrow morning, live at 9. Today, we're talking with Department of Environmental Services Commissioner Tom Burek. And let's hear from you now at 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. And Commissioner Burek, here's an email I want to share with you. This is from Alex, who says, why did Commissioner Burek just punt your question about the implementation of rail? Talking about the need to increase bus usage is not an adequate response to this question of the need for train services. The construction of a train from Nashua to Boston, for example, would have overwhelming benefits to the environment. Why is there this constant deference to bus services by politicians and bureaucrats when the question of high-speed rail arises? And Alex, thanks for the question. And, you know, we could talk about this for hours, and we have on this program. But Alex is right. Politicians in New Hampshire do seem more in favor of bus than rail.
And in all candor, this is not a topic on which our department, DES, has really been very actively engaged, I think in part because we have not, to my knowledge, typically been invited to participate in the conversations.
Really? That is, Why is that?
Because
there are environmental benefits,
well,
as she
clearly
says.
Clearly there are environmental benefits to trains and to train service. But I think for the most part, as I've understood the conversations, they have really focused more on the funding side of things and on sort of one form of transit versus another, as opposed to should we be doing transit at all versus just doing our roadways. And I think from an environmental standpoint, it's very clear, and I think our department's been very clear about over the years that we see huge benefits to all forms of public transit, and certainly trains are one of those. But again, we simply haven't been a party that has been typically been invited to the table.
Would you like to be invited to the table?
Well, again, there are certainly would be interests of ours in being able to participate, but we would not necessarily bring a whole lot of additional expertise to the table, and certainly we wouldn't be in a position to bring funding to the table.
And the funding's the issue at this point in time.
As I understand it, that's really a key piece of all of this.
Well, and a big debate over whether it's worth it or not, whether New Hampshire has the population density, whether people would actually use it. And we have definitely, Alex, just to let you know, talked about this in other shows. So I'm going to leave that for now, but I really appreciate the email. Here's another email from Carolyn, who says, back in the 70s, with major federal support, a system of waste treatment plants was built. Now those plants need major upgrades, maintenance, even replacement. Carolyn asks, what's being done to make those upgrades, replacements happen without bankrupting the municipalities where they exist? Carolyn, by the way, emailing from Gilmanton. This has been a huge issue, to my knowledge, especially in the Great Bay Area. I'm a little less familiar with this issue in Gilmanton, but it's a big issue. She's right. Thank you, Carolyn.
Carolyn, thank you for that. That's a very, very important challenge that we face as a state and as a nation, in fact. Just here in New Hampshire alone, as we look out over the next 10 years, we anticipate that we're going to have to spend some $2.9 billion, that's with a B, dollars, to upgrade our wastewater systems, our drinking water systems, our stormwater management systems, our dams, and a big chunk of that, probably between $1.5 and $2 billion of that, is just for wastewater treatment plants. Because, as you point out, most of these plants were built typically with 75% federal dollars, 20% state dollars, 5% local dollars back in the 1970s and 1980s. And they are all getting old. They're 25 to 35 years old. They're at capacity. They need to be upgraded. Our standards for meeting water quality protections are becoming more stringent. And so for all of these reasons, these plants need to be upgraded. And how are we going to pay for this is a vital question, because we no longer have a federal grant program. What we have is a federal loan program that enables us to run a low-interest loan program for municipalities across the state. And we're able to do some principal forgiveness under that program, but it's limited. For smaller communities, that is under 10,000, the Rural Development Authority of the Natural Resource Conservation Service, which is part of the U.S. Department of Agriculture, has some very attractive grant programs available. But this is a very real and very important challenge, and we have not in recent years had the level of state aid grant monies to help these communities. We're working with the legislature this year in hopes of being able to start to get more money back into that program. But I believe that as a state, we need to start finding new resources to meet this challenge.
Yeah, and a couple of years ago, we did a whole series on New Hampshire's drinking water challenges, and certainly aging wastewater treatment plants were a giant part of that. Let's go back to our listeners, if we could. Commissioner Burak, and Alan's waiting in Franklin. Hi, Alan. You're on the air with Commissioner Tom Burak. Go ahead.
Yes, good morning. I have a question for the commissioner that also relates to Great Bay. And it is, in light of the extreme costs and high user costs that are projected for upgrading treatment plants based on what the Environmental Protection Agency sees for discharge limitations, wondering how the agency views it in light of the fact that some very highly qualified water quality specialists have suggested that it's unlikely that all this work will have a significant impact on water quality. And I'll take the response off the air.
So, Alan, some feeling, let me see if I got you right, some feeling that the requirements by EPA are too stringent and won't have a major impact on water quality. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, it's been studied by some highly qualified water quality specialists, and indications are that there'll be very limited improvement in water quality at an extremely high expense.
Okay, Alan, thanks a lot for calling. This is a giant issue. And just to let you, Alan, and others know, we did do an entire program on this about a year ago or so, I think. So if you want to go to the website and learn more, for sure. But let's address it, Commissioner Burak. Boy, the towns in the Great Bay and you guys at DES and EPA, you've been going back and forth on this for years.
This is a very important challenge to the state of New Hampshire because Great Bay is a vital natural resource. It's in some respects a hidden resource because there aren't a lot of big roads that go right next to it other than the major highway running north from Portsmouth to Dover. But it's something we have to protect, and I think there is broad recognition and understanding among the scientific community that has looked at this that there is too much nitrogen there, and too much nitrogen is not a good thing. We need a certain amount of it, but we don't want too much of it. And that nitrogen is coming from a variety of sources. It's certainly coming from the wastewater treatment plants there, but it's also coming from the non-point sources as well. And within the next couple of weeks, we at the Department of Environmental Services will be releasing a draft of a study that we've done trying to model what we think the different sources are on a sort of a sub – what we call a sub-watershed basis, that is fairly small geographic areas. How much of this is coming from fertilizer, how much of it is coming out of septic systems, how much is coming in the form of atmospheric deposition, that is, what falls out of the sky.
That's non-point sources.
That's
instead of coming from one big pipe, it's coming from, you working on your lawn and me, spilling some oil when I fill up my car.
That's right. Exactly. And the challenge that we're going to face all over the next 10 to 20 years or so is to figure out how can we most cost-effectively get the necessary reductions to be able to restore and, in the long term, ensure the health of Great Bay, and to do this before it's too late and before we go the way of the Chesapeake Bay, for example, or even Narragansett Bay, and it just gets too late, and we get truly a dead system there. That's not anything that I believe anybody wants to see. And so we're working, coming back to the question, we're working very closely with the communities and EPA to try to find a path forward here that ensures that the monies that are being spent are being spent as cost effectively as possible.
Why has this taken so long, Commissioner Burak? I mean, I've done multiple shows on this. Our environment reporters and multiple reports on this. We've been looking at this for years. Why are we still going around and around on this when, as you said, nobody wants the Great Bay to die?
Well, I don't think we are going around and around on it. I think real progress is being made. We've done a lot of study here, but EPA has also recently completed permitting processes with two of the communities, that is with Exeter and Newmarket, for them to upgrade their wastewater treatment plants. They are in ongoing discussions now with three other communities, that is Dover, Portsmouth, and Rochester. And as I mentioned before, we are also working very hard in focusing on the stormwater side of things. And EPA has also recently issued a draft stormwater permit that would affect a number of these communities as well. And we're working with the communities and EPA to, again, make sure that we're working collectively and collaboratively on a sensible approach forward to make sure that what we're doing is going to get us real environmental benefit.
Well, and that was Alan's critique. He felt like EPA's desires were not going to bring that environmental benefit, and as he said, at a huge high cost. What do you think? Is EPA asking for too much here?
Well, obviously, I can't speak for EPA. What I can say is that EPA has mandates under the Federal Clean Water Act. They are the permitting authority here in New Hampshire for these types of facilities.
It's not you.
Well, that That's correct. We're certainly in the middle of all of this.
Getting that impression, yes.
And so we try very hard to bring the parties together and find constructive approaches.
Thanks a lot for that, Carl Allen. Huge issue. And let's go next to Buddy, waiting a long time in Brookline. Hey, Buddy, thanks for hanging on. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Good morning. Thank you. I'm also a CONCOM member in Brookline. And last Saturday, we had our annual Nissitissit River canoe trip. And there's a lady from Mason, Gwen Whitbeck, who is the canoe trip director, and she spoke very passionately about the tar sands oil being transported through northern New Hampshire or planned to be transported through northern New Hampshire. Now, the Nissitissit couldn't be any farther away from this, so it's not a in-my-backyard issue. But what about the DES's stand on allowing tar sand oil to come through the state?
Yeah, and this has just come up recently, right, Commissioner Burek? Thanks a lot, buddy. I just saw something on this a couple of days ago.
A little background here. There is a pipeline that was actually built during World War II by the Allies that runs from Portland to Montreal, and it is used to pump crude oil from the coast up to a refinery in Montreal.
And it goes through northern New Hampshire
towns.
And
it goes through five northern New Hampshire towns. And there are actually two different pipelines there. There's a 24-inch line and an 18-inch line. The 24-inch line is what actually currently carries the crude. And then there's this 18-inch line, which is dormant. I think they have it filled with nitrogen to protect the pipeline. And there has been some talk that perhaps that pipeline might be used as a way of moving what are called tar sands oil. Some call it dilute bitumen, or dilbit is the short word for it, to move it actually in the opposite direction, that is to move it out of Canada, across the U.S., out to a seaport such as Portland, from which it could then be shipped to various markets. What we understand is that the company does not currently have an active project associated with moving these Western Canadian crudes in that direction, but certainly they have told us they're also always looking to expand their markets and use their pipelines as best they can. In terms of the regulation of the pipeline itself, it's actually regulated only by the federal government through what's called the Office of Pipeline Safety, which is part of the U.S. Department of Transportation. And from a New Hampshire regulatory standpoint, our department actually works very closely with the pipeline owners to make sure that they have appropriate spill control plans and measures and equipment in place.
That's where you
come in. And that's where we come in with respect to this.
Not in terms of permitting. Not
in terms of permitting directly. So we're certainly actively monitoring the situation, but at this point there isn't a particular proposal that we're looking at. We talked before about the site evaluation committee. We also don't know whether a matter of this kind might find itself before the site evaluation committee.
Right. Well, Buddy, thanks for bringing that up, because that's a relatively new development. So thanks for joining us. You know, just a couple last questions for you, Commissioner Burek. Your agency had a huge victory recently in the case against ExxonMobil. A jury awarded an unprecedented amount of money to the state for cleanup related to Exxon's use of the carcinogen MTBE, which was added to gasoline to try to make it less smoggy, if I could put it that way. Here's the question that I have about this. And we should say Exxon is appealing, so everybody celebrated, but not very long because Exxon's appealing. Exxon says, look, the federal government made us do this. They told us to come out with additives that would make gasoline less air polluting. We did, and now we're getting in trouble for it.
I understand that was probably one of the arguments that Exxon made. I think it's fair to say that the jury here in New Hampshire heard that argument and did not find it compelling. And we have to believe that's why they awarded us a verdict of some $236 million against ExxonMobil to help us meet the challenge of cleaning up this problem. And it's important to understand the extent of the problem, because it's huge. We have 1,600 sites or so in New Hampshire with MTBE contamination. 1,600 known sites. Our experts also estimate there are probably nearly another 5,600 private drinking water wells that probably serve approximately 16,000 residents here in the state with MTBE levels above the standard, and people don't even know that they're drinking it.
Wow.
And so the funds that we have secured both through the settlements already and that we hope that we will ultimately secure through final appeals on the ExxonMobil portion of the case will be not even enough to help us meet the basic needs that we have to meet, which is to clean up the existing contamination source areas, to put in protective measures so that we can find old gasoline, get it disposed of properly, whether it's from old vehicles that are stored in junkyards or elsewhere, close abandoned wells that could enable MTBE to get into the aquifers, and then, assuming that we have funds available to do this, start going out and testing additional wells and finding these wells that our experts tell us they believe are going to be there, and getting those private wells cleaned up as well.
So about 40%, as I understand, of New Hampshire residents get their drinking water from private wells, roughly. So what's the message for them there? I mean, should people who are on a private well, can they get their water tested for MTBE?
We certainly encourage them to, on their own, get the testing done. We don't have plans established yet for how and when and in what fashion we're going to be able to use some of these funds to go out and start working with homeowners directly to do this testing.
Okay. Well, Commissioner Burak, lots to talk about this morning. Thank you so much for coming in.
You're welcome.
That's Tom Burak, Commissioner of the New Hampshire Department of Environmental Services. He's been in that position for 7 years. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producer is Ellen Grimm. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. Our intern is Faith Meixel. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. The Exchange's executive producer is Keith Shields, and I'm Laura Kanoy.